Welcome to Stacktrace, the podcast that is all about life and technology from two developers' perspectives, with me, John Sundell, and my good friend, Mr. Guy Rambo. How's it going, Mr. Rambo?
I'm doing great, John. How are you?
I'm doing great as well. It's been a little while since we last recorded an episode, so I'm really excited to talk to you, especially like this time of the year when there's all this new stuff from WWDC. We've both been shipping some new things. I mean, you've been shipping quite a lot of new things. So very excited about this episode.
Yeah, indeed. I'm very busy right now with a bunch of stuff that I will talk about soon. But first, I want to hear, what have you been up to since DubDub week and all of the new announcements? Are you doing anything cool with the new stuff yet? Or are you focusing on other things that you had already been working on?
So it's been a kind of nice mix over the last few weeks of both exploring the new WWDC content, like the sessions and the new documentation, which I mentioned it on the last episode of the Swift by Sundell podcast, and I will mention it here again, is that I am very happy to see Apple step up the quality of the documentation this year. Like, the new APIs that I've been exploring so far, the vast majority of them have had really good documentation. Like, perhaps there are not these like really long documents that there used to be about things like core animation and these like long like descriptions of the frameworks and so themselves. But when it comes to actual API documentation, I haven't found that many like no overview available anymore. Like, it's been really good coverage in terms of the documentation, which I'm very, very happy to see. So I've been exploring that a lot, been watching videos, and I've been, of course, playing around with the APIs. So that's been really neat. I've taken Swift charts for a few spins, and I've started using some of the new Swift UI layout tools, which I'm sure we're going to talk about later in this episode. And yeah, it's just been really great. And also starting to migrate some of my client projects to these new versions as well, making some conditional use of some of the new APIs, and also adopting Swift 5.7, which with its new generics features, like, gives you, or at least has given me, quite a lot of opportunities to clean up old code where I had to do a lot of like type erasure and these sorts of things that is not really needed anymore, which is really neat.
Yeah, I think that's one of my favorite new things, because I was never really a fan of type erasure, of doing it manually. It always felt like I was doing something wrong because I'm not very used to that. So the few times I've had to do that, sometimes I would end up with a completely different solution and API in the end because I didn't want to have to deal with that. And now I'm going back and reevaluating some of those decisions and seeing where I can take advantage of this new stuff, which is still basically type erasure, but it's done for you and you don't have to worry about it so much when you're working with the API. And I think the best like summary of what's changed there was your episode of Swift by Sundell right after WWDC, where I basically learned everything I know about this new stuff other than my own experimentation.
Yeah, I'm really happy to hear that. And I'm very happy with how that episode turned out, for sure. And it's been really great to also get the feedback on that episode and hearing people say similar things like you just said. Like, that was a very nice way to kind of get into these features, because generics just by themselves is kind of inherently a pretty complicated topic because it's so abstract, right? Like, we're not talking about modeling something specific like a UI. We're talking about like really just like structuring our code on almost like a meta level, right?
Yeah.
In fact, like, there's a lot of meta types and things like that involved in generics, so kind of makes sense. But it can be hard to kind of get into, but once you kind of learn what is this new any keyword, what is the sum keyword, like, what does it mean for something to be an existential and so on. And I also followed that episode up also with an article as well, where I also went into some details around these new keywords. So hopefully between like different podcasts and articles and the documentation and so on, that, you know, people can start getting into these new features. And I'm hoping also to continue to write about them as I continue to actually use them to solve like practical problems within my different projects. I'm sure I will come up with new ways to kind of explain these features and talk about them in different ways. And it's really, really cool, I think, that we now have this all baked into the language and we can kind of make better use of generics, like you said, without having to write all of this extra code, like type erasure wrappers and things like that, by ourselves. Because, you know, the point of generics in many cases is to not have to duplicate code, right? To be able to save time and say, like, write less code by reusing things in a generic way. But if we then have to write all this extra infrastructure around it, it kind of defeats the purpose, right?
Yeah.
So I think it's great that generics are becoming a little bit more lightweight in a way with Swift 5.7.
Yeah, absolutely. And I've been happy with what I've done so far with them. And I think I'll just give the same advice I always give around generics, which is to not try to fit generics into a problem that you might have unless you think they actually solve the problem. Because I have seen it's one of those things that's really difficult for you to sit down and go like, okay, I'm going to use generics now. It's usually not how that works. The places where I ended up using generics and where I actually liked to use generics were actual problems I was having where I came up with a solution that ended up using generics and that worked. It wasn't where I sat down and was like, let me use generics. So in a sense, it's difficult to learn because if you try to apply generics to like an abstract problem just for learning and you do like the foo bar kind of thing, it just becomes like just too meta almost.
Yeah.
So your head's gonna spin basically. So don't feel like you have to learn this just to learn it. When you think you have a problem where generics might be the solution, maybe try to apply them. And if it doesn't work, just go back and do it in another way and then maybe try again later. And it's one of the things, again, that I like about Swift in general is that you don't have to learn this stuff in order to use the language. It's definitely more advanced and you can definitely be a very good Swift developer without ever doing like your own generics necessarily. That's something that takes a while to get used to, definitely.
Yeah, absolutely. And you're absolutely right that it sort of becomes like a chicken and an egg problem where it's like, you want to learn about generics, but in order to learn properly about generics, you probably need to have a use case for it. But how can you know what the use case is if you don't know about generics, right?
Yeah.
But I think a really nice sort of initial context that a lot of people might start encountering generics in a kind of neat way is when using SwiftUI, because SwiftUI does itself make so heavy use of generics. And what that means is when you want to build, for example, your own custom container, like just today, actually, I was working on this kind of custom label that displays like a prefix view and then a text. And I wanted the prefix view to not just be able to be like an icon, but to be able to be any view. And when you want to do something like that in SwiftUI, like build something dynamic, you pretty much have to use generics unless you're going to start using any view, which, as we know, is not great. And we'll leave a link in the show notes to an article I wrote about, you know, what exactly is the problem with any view, which is, again, type erasure, right? Like,
yeah.
Type erasure is not always bad, but in the case of SwiftUI, it does give you some problems when it comes to performance and animations and so on, because the view hierarchy kind of becomes more dynamic in a way that's not great for the framework. But anyway, so the way that you typically want to solve these sorts of things is you wanted to accept a prefix type which conforms to view rather than accepting an any view instance. So then you can maintain that strong types. You can use generics in a way that makes your view super dynamic but still have great performance. And that, I think, is when people encounter that, and I'm also planning to write an article specifically about using generics in the context of SwiftUI. I think that's going to be a context where you can really make use of some of these features in a kind of natural way that is not just like, let me sit down in my code base and see where can I deploy generics, but, you know, in a way that actually is going to help you solve a lot of problems and build really nice views.
Yeah, definitely. And one way that I used, especially when I was not very used to SwiftUI yet and generics in general, and also something I still do to this day when I'm writing my own SwiftUI views that will be generic, is to look at how SwiftUI defines its own components. So you can command control click, I think that's the shortcut. You can command control click on like an H stack or a button that you have in your SwiftUI code, and you open up the definition for that interface. And so if you don't know the syntax or you're not quite sure how to go about it, you can do that and basically just like copy and paste the interface from the SwiftUI type and just rename it to your type and fill in the implementation, of course. So that's a tip as well. If you're not sure how to define your own generic view in SwiftUI, you can always resort to the built-in SwiftUI types to see how those are defined. And another thing that really helped me understand generics is to not think about them as like a dynamic thing, even though the end result is that it's quite dynamic in the sense that you can use different types of things, basically. But to think of it as more of a static thing that's basically writing code for you, which I think is what's happening under the hood, right? So you instead of thinking like, oh, this is something that can take any type of view that I have, think of it as this is a template, and I think that's what they're called in C++, actually, right?
Templates. Yeah, that's right.
So you can think of it as like this is a template where at compile time, the compiler is going to create a version of this that takes a button or a label or whatever, and it's just that you're writing it in this generic way to let the compiler know that you want it to create those implementations for you.
Yeah, I think that's a really great way of looking at it from a kind of conceptual level, is that you're writing templates that are then filled in for specific types, right? Like array is a template, and you can have an array of string that is a specialization of that template. So yeah, absolutely. I think that's great. Another thing that I've been busy with lately, besides all the WWDC stuff, is I've been actually also shipping some things. I've been working on some big new releases for some of my client projects, and that's been really, really fun. And that got me thinking about release processes in general, because, of course, different projects I work on, they have different release processes. Some of them are on kind of more like a specific release cadence where we ship a new version of the app every month or something like that. Of course, back when I was working at companies like Spotify, we had another kind of release process, which a lot of big tech companies use, where they ship the app sometimes even as frequent as like every second week or every week, I think some companies do. Yeah. So, you know, there's all these different ways you can deal with releases. And of course, some companies, they just release whenever they feel like they have something to ship, right? And whenever they feel like they want to actually bundle things up into a release and call it like a specific version. A part of that also, I've been having to kind of work with the different teams that I work with to decide, like, if we have some specific bug, how do we decide whether we want to fix it as part of the current release, like before we ship it, or if it's fine to wait until the next release and maybe do like a point update to fix a few bugs and things like that. So I thought that could be fun to talk about here for a few minutes, like what our preferred release processes are and how we kind of deal with releases in general. So from my perspective, like the way I like to work with releases is to have some kind of cadence. It doesn't have to be like monthly or, you know, weekly, definitely not weekly, especially not when I'm working like on my own as a freelancer or like with a very small team. That's very, very hard to ship an app like every week. But, you know, it can be something like every second month or every month or something like that. Maybe there's a specific date in the month that we aim to do a release around. So it doesn't have to be like super strict. It can be like, you know, around the 20th of every month, we aim to ship a release, and it can be on the 22nd or on the 19th or whenever we feel ready. But to have some kind of point in every month or every second month or something like that, like some kind of cadence where before the release is going to happen, so like a week or so before the release is scheduled to go out, I like to cut a release branch. So what I do then is I take the main branch and I branch out into like a release slash the version number branch. And that then becomes the release branch. And then any fix that is supposed to go into the release, I make on that release branch. So I just, you know, target the commit onto that specific branch. And then it's great to have, like, if it's possible, to have some automation to merge that release branch back into the project's main branch, or perhaps, you know, create a pull request that you can then review before you want to merge it back in, because maybe you don't want to automate that, you know, because there could be some strange things happening during the merging process. But to have some way of like branching off into a specific branch for the release to make fixes on that branch specifically, and to then merge that branch back into the main branch, either manually or through some automation or maybe some combination of the two. And then you kind of continue with the next release. And the reason I like to have that kind of workflow is because that, I feel like, gives the team really good options when it comes to deciding, like, you have a specific commit or a specific fix. Does this go into the main branch or does it go into the release branch? And here you have to kind of decide, okay, what are the potential downsides of merging this fix in. Like perhaps it could trigger some kind of side effect, and perhaps it has to touch a lot of different code in order to fix this particular bug. And maybe we don't want to take that risk in order to, you know, have to avoid doing another big round of regression testing. So maybe we're going to wait until the next release if it's not a severe bug and so on. But I like that kind of process of having these two branches and then merging the release branch back into the main branch and then continue working on the next version. Or how do you like to treat your releases, Rambo?
Yeah, I think that process works really well for teams. It's very similar to what we did back at the Jobby Job, and I think I was the main proponent of that process. Working by myself in something like Airbuddy, it's a bit different, and it's kind of funny because, like, the main branch on my repo basically means nothing. Like, I really don't use the main branch at all, because since it's just myself, like, there is no point, really. So I basically have been doing per release branches, basically. So I have like a v2.5.something branch, and everything that goes into that release is going to be in that branch. And when it comes time to branch out into a new release, I create a new branch and so on and so forth. And right now I have a v3.0 branch because I am working on version 3 of Airbuddy, which I think is a bit of breaking news or exclusive here on Stacktrace. And I of course, I have like a v2 dot whatever the latest 2 dot something version was, and it's still there. So if something pops up that I need to release before 3.0, I can branch out of that previous version branch, fix it in there, and do the release and everything. And if I have to, which is usually the case, I can then just merge that version branch back into the 3.0, or just cherry pick the individual commit that fixed the thing. It doesn't happen very often. And one of the reasons why I decided to move over to entirely focusing on this big new release now is because the version that's out there right now is fairly stable. It doesn't have many like big issues or anything, so I thought it was a good opportunity to just leave that as is and focus on working on this new thing. But yeah, that's basically my process. I just keep pulling branches for new releases, because I always plan like, oh, the next version is going to be this one, so I just pull that branch, and if some emergency comes up, I can always just go back into the previous version's branch and do whatever I need to do in there. And this is also going to help me now that I'll be basically having like kind of a legacy version of the app up, because I am raising the deployment target with 3.0, and the 2.x version will continue to receive minor fixes and improvements for people who are on older operating systems. So having that separate branch strategy really helps with this approach. So yeah, basically my main branch, it's just there. Like, I don't really use it.
All right. So you basically never have a reason to work on two upcoming new versions at the same time, because that's the reason you typically want to have a release branch and still use your main branch, is because if someone on the team, and I know you're just working by yourself, right? But it can also be so I have some projects that I work on that I'm working on my own as well, and I still like to have these two branches, because sometimes I want to make a commit that I don't feel like should go into the release branch, because maybe, you know, the client is working right now on QA on that release candidate, and I don't want to add new commits to it, because then they basically have to start testing again, right? So yeah. Then I commit those onto the main branch, not to the release branch. And then if they report any bugs to me or anything that should be fixed for the release, then those commits go into the release branch. So I still like to have two branches going whenever there's a release about to happen, just because I can always make that decision, like, does this commit go to the main branch or to the release branch? But that's not a situation that you usually have, I guess. So what about when you have betas, for example? Like, if you have a beta out that you're working on and you still want to make some commits to like a future version. Does that ever happen?
It doesn't really, because the reality is that I am a single developer, so I can't really be working on three different versions at the same time. So whenever that happens, it's usually like some sort of, I use the word emergency, but it's never really an emergency, but like a more urgent thing that I need to fix for something. And since I'm a single developer, I can cherry pick the changes to the other branch if I need to. So I can take those shortcuts because I am a single developer and there's no like client that needs to test the app or something. So yeah, that's basically how I do things because I am a single developer. I think it works well for an indie developer, but yeah, if you have a client or if you're working as a team, then things have to be a little bit different. So in a sense, like my release branch is kind of like the main branch in a sense. So like the 3.0 branch right now is where everything goes.
Right.
But when I'm about to ship that, I will create like a 3.1 or like the 3.0 whatever branch. And then that's going to be like the quote main branch. And then if there's like something that I change that's very like risky to do right before a release, that goes into this new branch in order to, yeah, prevent like something from breaking unexpectedly. So it's always like basically always keyed by release. That's how I do it.
Yeah, that's cool. And I guess like a great like a way to summarize this discussion is that use whatever workflow works for you and your team, right? Like there's no reason to start working on it with a more complex workflow or some specific way that doesn't like fit the way you like to think, because there are many ways to use Git here. For example, you could use Git tags and you could use GitHub, for example, to manage your releases and so on, which uses tags if that's what you want. So there's no right or wrong way here, I think. It's all about like, what does a team like to do? And also like, how do you like to structure things? Because the reason I like to keep my branches that I work with currently to a minimum, like I always like to just have the release branch and the main branch, and then that's it. And once a release is shipped, I can then tag that, archive that, and then that's done, right? Unless I need to go back and, you know, do a hotfix, then I can get that commit back that I was shipped last to the app store, and I can then add a new commit on top of that with a new release branch, right? So, but in general, like in the normal circumstances, I just have two branches, the main branch and the release branch. And the reason I like that is because I always get really nervous otherwise that I lost a commit somewhere that, you know, there's a commit on this other release branch, like on the fifth one that I forgot to cherry pick onto my main branch or something, right? So I like to always have that, you know, the release branch is what I'm working on when I'm stabilizing the release, and that just gets continuously always merged back into the main branch. So I know that I'm not leaving a commit behind.
Yeah, so what I do in order to not have that happen is I don't just rely on Git itself. I rely very heavily on GitHub issues. The whole like company is run on GitHub issues, basically. So if I am in that situation, which has happened before, where I had the next release that I'm finishing up and there's this other branch for the next from the next release, I will file GitHub issues with like sometimes even like have them on a milestone with a deadline, where I basically like list the hashes of the commits that must go onto this other branch or something like that. So you have to be disciplined to actually follow that workflow, especially when you're working by yourself, and it's so easy to not be disciplined. But I really do that because I've been bitten in the past by not following that strictly. And I even have like a whole setup on my terminal where I have this GH issue alias that I wrote, where I can basically tell that directory that I'm currently working on this particular issue, and any commits that I make will automatically be tagged with that issue number, because I was tired of having to look up issue numbers and type them manually. So I've even done that because I do like for everything that I do to be tied to an issue, so that I can always go back and see why that was done. And I write like I could probably like publish a book from all of the GitHub issues in the Everybody repo, because I write like a lot. Like I do a lot of research of different solutions, and then I will go in the issue and actually like almost as if I'm writing for someone else, because me in the future is someone else basically. So I basically explain like my reasoning behind things, and even have like almost like discussions with myself. Oh, my therapist would love to hear about this. So, but yeah, it is a bit weird because it's just me. But I mean, hey, if anyone else comes into the project at some point, like let's say I grow to a point where I have to hire someone to work with me, they'll be very happy that I've done this.
Yeah. And another thing also, I found that the more you kind of write that sort of documentation and issues, and you write good commit messages, you don't just put like fixing some stuff in the commit message, but you actually write like a, you know, nice description of what you just did. Like, not only does that help yourself in the future when you need to go back and check something that you did, but I also find that it helps me prevent mistakes. That yeah. When I look at something again from a kind of slightly different perspective, like I open up the Git diff and I sit down and actually write a good commit message, it's not something I spend like 5 hours on, of course. It's something that just takes a few minutes. But just that little context switch where I just sit down and I look at my code from a different perspective, I found so many potential bugs or just code that didn't really make sense, or I left some print statements in there, or something mistake, like in general. Like I found that it's such a nice way to not prevent mistakes completely, of course, because we're all human and we make mistakes, but to reduce the risk of mistakes, because you just end up kind of double and triple checking your own work, even if you don't have someone else to review it. So I find that to be really, really helpful as well.
Yeah, definitely.
So speaking about releases, Rambo, I know that you've been shipping quite a lot of things lately. So why don't you tell us, what have you been up to lately?
Yeah, sure. So, like I said, I've been working on a big update to Everybody, as I'm usually doing, but this time it's a major release, and we'll talk more about this in future episodes. I've also open sourced my Virtual Buddy project. So,
all right.
This is my virtual machine thing that we talked about a few episodes back, and it's now open source. It's on my GitHub. It's gotten way more attention than I think it deserves. I'm happy that people have been enjoying it. It's a very early stage kind of project. I even put like a big warning in the README, like basically don't rely on this for anything important. It's an experiment, and I'm just happy that people have been enjoying it. And something I've done with this project that I haven't done before. So we've talked about not using GitHub issues for some of our open source projects, because that ends up like becoming like a support ticketing system almost, depending on the project. And of course, it depends a lot on the project and your priorities. But in my case, I definitely don't have the bandwidth to be managing GitHub issues for my projects. But GitHub has introduced this discussions feature, which is almost like a built-in forum or Stack Overflow of sorts. And I left that enabled, and it's been working quite well, actually. There are people reporting bugs in there and things like that. But I mean, of course, that's normal. That's to be expected. But there's also like a bunch of cases where someone doesn't know how to do something, or they have a question, and it even has like this built-in Q&A functionality where you can even mark a question as mark an answer as like the correct answer, and it will be highlighted, kind of like Stack Overflow basically. So what's been happening that I've been seeing there is that people who are trying to use the app and people who have issues and things like that, they will post something in discussions and someone else will come along and help them. And lots of issues have been solved in that way. So I'm happy with this new model of basically having a built-in community within the GitHub project where users and developers can help each other out.
Yeah, that's super cool. I've also been considering enabling that for some of my projects as well. It seems like a really neat feature. And it's sort of actually what I wanted when I first started talking about removing issues or disabling issues on my open source projects, because I felt like the whole like the way it's named with it's called issues, right? And the kind of way most projects use them and the way developers are used to them and the way we kind of think about issues on GitHub kind of led to it becoming, like you said, like it's people feel a lot of the times that they can report something in the issues and they have an expectation that then someone will just go and fix it, right?
Yeah.
And of course, if it's a severe issue and something that affects a lot of users, if I had such a report, I would go ahead and fix it because it would probably also affect my usage. And I want people who use my projects to be able to use them in a nice way. But it so often ends up becoming really overwhelming for the maintainers. And especially when there's all these kind of feature requests coming in there. And again, people, not everyone, of course, a lot of people are very nice and things like that. But some people, they really have the expectation that if they add an issue, then you will someone will fix it and they will start pinging you and ask, like, is there any updates on this, right? Like,
yeah.
You know, it's kind of like it's sort of becoming your work. And like you said, depending on how you're prioritizing or what capacity you have to do something, like sometimes I think it's fine for someone to say, here's an open source project that I made. You can use it for free. Here it is. But I'm not necessarily going to implement like every single feature that everyone is asking for, right? Like, because yeah. I don't have the time or, you know, I made this mainly for myself and you can use it and have fun, but it's not something that I want to like cater to every use case, right?
Mm-hmm.
But discussion seems like a really like productive, nice thing to do and also to a way to kind of build a community a little bit around a project. So it is definitely something that, you know, once I get a little bit more bandwidth right now, I still have a hard time working on open source at all because of priorities and lack of time. But I really hope that one day I will be able to have discussions opened and engage with people a little bit more around the open source projects that I work on because it seems like a really neat feature.
Yeah, the way I look at my participation in open source in terms of my own projects is not, I don't want to be an open source maintainer. Like, that's not my job. I don't get paid for that, unfortunately. I would love to if I could work on that full time, but the reality is I have other stuff that's more important right now. So the way I see it is I want to share code in a way that other people can take advantage of, but just don't bother me. Like, here's like, I've spent several hours working on this on top of several years of experience and experimentation. I'm putting this out for free. So feel free, like copy and paste it, do whatever you want, but just don't bother me.
And it's such a tricky subject, this one, right?
Yeah.
Because of course you want to be nice and like, I love that people use the stuff that I build, right? Like, I'm sure we're going to talk about it soon, but you know, a lot of people use Publish now, right? Like a lot of websites, I've kind of lost count now of how many websites use Publish. And I want these people who use this tool to have a great time, right? And be happy and be able to build what they want to build. And you know, there's a balance there between that and what time you actually have available to do this, which, like you said, is essentially free work, right? That you're putting in to benefit the community or because you find it interesting. And kind of the way I've approached this recently, like during the last couple of years, is because I really want to reduce that maintenance burden on myself, just because I know that if I don't do that, I'm just going to, you know, get really stressed or really not have the time to be able to work on these things at all. So the way I've been dealing with it is really to just try to open up the tools as much as possible. So if you look at, you know, Plot and Publish and all these tools that I built during the last couple of years, they all have like plugin systems and they can be customized in like so many different ways just to enable people to kind of build their own extensions to the tools rather than always relying on the maintainer, which is me, to kind of implement those things for them.
Yeah, absolutely. And speaking of which, I think it's time to talk about Publish.
Yeah.
It's the static site generation corner, but not so much because there's a lot more involved here.
But now it's Rambo's static site generation corner, not mine. The corner has moved to Brazil.
Yeah. So basically what happened is this friend of mine, my friend Marcus, we had been talking about his idea to create a podcast network focused on tech podcasts in Brazil for the Brazilian audience in Portuguese. But of course, it like also works for people in Portugal and other countries that speak Portuguese. And recently, everything lined up and we decided that it was time. So we founded Gigahertz, which is this podcast network for tech podcasts in Brazil. And that's probably why probably our listeners haven't really heard about it because it's a thing for a Brazilian audience mainly, and it's in Portuguese, and we don't speak Portuguese in this show, so I think we probably do have a few people from Brazil and Portugal and whatnot that listen to Stack Trace, but yeah, we decided that it was time to do it, and given that I am the developer of the group, I ended up taking on the responsibility of putting things online. And these days, like, how do you start a podcast network? It's like, how do you start a podcast, but times four in our case, because we have four shows at the moment. And we have one show which was already in existence, basically. So it's been releasing episodes for a long time, and it's over 200 episodes now. But the other shows were all brand new. And the challenge was, how do we put this online, and what sort of infrastructure do we want to use, and what's the website gonna be like? And I basically decided to go all in on Publish for the website, which has been powering the network for a bit over a month, I think. Maybe a little bit. Yeah, a little bit over a month. And I must say, I've had a really good experience building the Gigahertz website using Publish. And you think, like, Publish is, in a sense, you made it for your blog. So the way it's structured, it is mainly focusing on building this one blog. But of course, you can build other types of websites, but it really works perfectly for the use case of, like, your blog or my blog or other people's blogs. And it supports podcasts as well. But in this case, it's like this portal where you have multiple, almost like sub-websites, but it's all using the same layout, of course, but you have multiple feeds for the different shows. And we also have, like, the thing we call, like, the super feed, which is like this single feed that publishes all shows. And I was able to do all of that with Publish. And I'm very happy about it.
That's so cool. Yeah, I'm very, very happy to hear that. And I must say, like, when you first told me that you were going to build this using Publish, I was a little bit surprised. Like, I was very happy. But like you said, like, because it's a static site generator, like, so much of it is focused on, well, generating static content, right? Like, where you have a single publisher and you might be writing articles, or maybe it's not a blog even. Maybe it's just a website, like a portfolio. Like, I know a lot of people use Publish for that. But something that, you know, you build it once, then whenever you need to add something to it, you add that content and you regenerate the site, you upload the HTML to your server, and then you're done, right?
Yeah.
But in your case, like, you have this, like, content management system, basically, right? Because you need multiple people to be able to upload different episodes on their own podcasts without you, like, you know, them sending the MP3 to you and you, okay, let me regenerate the website here, right? Like, you needed that to be all dynamic, and you build some infrastructure for that, which I definitely want to hear more about. But I'm very happy that it worked out so well. And I kind of want to start by asking you, like, because, like we just mentioned, Publish is kind of like the default kind of publishing pipeline that you get from the framework is very much designed around, like, you add markdown files to your content folder and you regenerate the website. So how much custom stuff did you need to build? Like, were you able to utilize many of the built-in kind of generation steps, or did you have to, like, build your own generation pipeline kind of, but using the Publish library?
Yeah, so there is a lot of customization going on. Of course, there are lots of custom plugins. And there was a thing where, so I am using a fork of Publish, basically, and I plan on contributing back some of the things I've done, of course. The main thing I started the fork because I wanted to use the internal feed generator thing that you've built for Publish, but that's internal. It's not public in Publish. And the built-in support for podcast feeds, I wasn't able to use, like, the vanilla generate podcast feed step to generate multiple feeds.
Right, yeah, that makes total sense, because I think that was very much designed with the idea that you have a website which has a podcast, right? Not you have a website which has N number of podcasts. So yeah, that makes total sense.
Yeah, and one thing I considered as I was just getting started was maybe each podcast should be its own published website, and then I could like merge all of them together. But I didn't even like try that because I thought it would be too complicated. So I chose to extend publish and allow it to let me use the feed generator in this special way, basically. But the way it's exposed in the way I use it in the website is basically another plugin. So the main thing is that I didn't want to write my own feed generator, which I definitely could, like using the plot components and everything. But yeah, I wanted to leverage your work, and it's all covered by tests and all of the good stuff. So I was more confident about, let me just change this internal to public, and that, right. That will be fine. So we'll see if there's a way that we can integrate that into publish somehow. I've done some other things, which I don't quite remember. But yeah, there were like some extra fields that I wanted to customize in the podcast feeds and things like that. But yeah, in general, it wasn't like, oh, Rambo rewrote publish from scratch. It was just like, let me just expose some of the internal things and yeah, just add like a couple of options to like the feed configuration struct.
Right. Yeah, that's super cool. And that's definitely something we should look into, like actually making a part of the framework, I think, especially when it enables new use cases by just moving something from the internal part of the library to the public part. And that's always kind of tricky, right? When you're designing an API, is that how much of the implementation details do you want to expose as part of the public API? Because, of course, the more you expose, also the surface for bugs or just the kind of maintenance aspect of the library usually becomes like a lot harder because, well, you have more APIs to support, right? And you also have to think about how they work in a kind of public API point of view, because when you're just consuming an API internally within the library, well, you can make certain assumptions or you know what kind of environment it's being used in, right? Because it's just used internally within this library. But all of a sudden, when you make it public, well, now anyone can use it and you have just an explosion of the number of environments that it can be used in, and you need to make sure it works in all those different environments. So yeah, definitely something I always am careful about to not make things public too quickly. But if it's a way to kind of make your use case and others who have something similar where they might want to have multiple podcasts and so on, you know, I think definitely we should look into making that happen.
Yeah, definitely. So that was like the main thing. And it's actually on my GitHub because that's where I host basically the Swift package. And we can leave a link in the show notes with the actual branch that I am pointing to in the Gigahertz website project. So if listeners want to explore what I have done there, feel free to do so. So you mentioned the thing where the publish was very much built as a tool for developers. And the way things work is, like you mentioned, you generate the website and upload the HTML. So when thinking about how I was going to approach this, I basically wanted to keep as much of that as possible, but in a way where I could expose some sort of interface where people could go and manage their own shows. That is not what's happening right now. So right now, what's happening is both me and Marcus, we are the ones who are publishing the episodes, and we have a very simple workflow where we have a shared Dropbox folder where we upload the audio files and the markdown files for each episode. And as of recently, he's actually using the GitHub UI to upload new episodes. At least like the markdown file, the actual MP3 is uploaded somewhere else. But yeah, he uses like the GitHub user interface and basically makes a pull request from the GitHub UI. He doesn't even know what a pull request is, but he knows how to do it in the GitHub UI, and that's perfectly fine. So when it comes time to release a new episode, he'll upload, do like the pull request there, and then I can just pull the pull request and push it to the server. And what I've done in order to make it ready so that I can in the future expose a like nicer UI or web portal or something for people to publish their shows is I, from the beginning, wanted the website to build on Linux. So I wanted it to build and generate perfectly fine on Linux. And the way I've done it was to use Docker containers. And I've been using Docker for quite a while for both development and production. And I am very happy with the setup that I got. So I've used like a multi-stage build process with Docker so that basically it will cache the build of the all of the dependencies. So publish itself and the website will all be cached. And then when I push to the production machine, it basically kicks off this Docker command that's going to build the website, generate the website, and the artifacts are then copied to the place where Nginx, which is the server, is looking at. And I've also written a plugin that basically computes hashes for each output file. And by the end of the website generating, it will know which files have changed, and it will issue a Cloudflare API call to clear the cache for those files that have changed, because I didn't want to clear the whole cache for the entire website zone, because that's a lot of stuff and that would end up causing too much bandwidth to be used. So I think that's pretty cool, and it's been working really well, I must say.
Yeah, that's super cool. And this is an approach that I think has so much potential. It's sort of a hybrid approach between a static website and a dynamic website, where you could observe all sorts of events. Like you could have an API, for example, like from your future content management system, where the content management system calls an API or uploads something, and that triggers the rebuilding of the website like you've already set up on your server. And then you sort of end up with, you're still statically generating the website, but you're doing it in a dynamic way, right?
Yeah.
So instead of serving every request as a dynamic request and response, like a, you know, fully dynamic website would, you are still like serving static content, but it's generated kind of continuously as the content changes, which I really think that has a huge amount of potential. And it's also sort of something I'm doing a little bit as part of my search feature on my website, where the search index itself is generated statically when I'm regenerating the website, like with all the keywords and the way the search works. And then the search algorithm that runs on the server, it really just kind of looks into that static search index and populates the results based on that, and actually inserts them into a statically generated template. So it's very much like a combination of the two there. And I've just like building that out and using that for a few years now in production. Like I feel like it has so much potential to do something like that.
Yeah, definitely. And I've actually built a very special API plugin as well for the website. So basically, every time it generates the website itself, it also generates this whole API structure where you can access pretty much all of the content from the website as JSON. And I haven't really talked about this API publicly yet, because I think it's probably too soon to like have people rely on it for anything. But if I ever want to, like, I don't know, make an app for the Gigahertz network, I could probably just use that API. And it's, at the end of the day, it's just static JSON files on the server. And that has so much potential, and it makes it so fast, because we rely heavily on Cloudflare for caching and CDN. So basically, anytime you're visiting the website, especially since it's so geographically centered in Brazil specifically, the chances are that any listener who's visiting the website is getting it directly from the Cloudflare CDN that's closest to them. So it's like really, really fast. And I've also done the same, not quite the same, but I have used the same code from your search index, which you shared with me, and adapted it to work with Portuguese, because I had to like do some stuff around diacritics and things like that.
Right.
But yeah, I've adapted the same thing, and I'm doing something different in the sense that instead of using the static template. I have like a piece of client-side JavaScript that I wrote that powers this search box, and then it does everything on the client side. So it will fetch the index, and it will then do everything on the browser. And to actually show like the list of search results, I have in that same plugin that generates the search index, I also made a way in which content can provide a snippet, basically. And the snippet is also statically generated, and it's like this static HTML file, and the search client will basically just find the results, and then using the path for the snippet will load that HTML from the server and just render it in line in the search box. So it feels like, oh, this is like some PHP API or some like really fancy search engine, but it's a static JSON file that's basically informing this JavaScript script that basically just fetches static HTML for the results and renders it. So that's also a lot of fun.
Yeah, that's super cool. And looking at this kind of from an architectural perspective, it's kind of interesting where what we're doing now essentially is that we're pre-computing the results, right? We're pre-computing different variants of the results even. Like we're creating hashes of different search queries and search keywords and then pre-computing what the results will be for those, right?
Yeah.
And the opposite approach to that would be to do a database fetch on every search query, or maybe something like a hybrid between the two where you might fetch from the database and then cache that. And then if some other user searches for the exact same search term, then you already have that cached for a certain amount of time. But the fact that we're doing this kind of static generation and then pre-computing all the different kind of lookups that can happen, I find that to just be very interesting. And I feel like it's almost similar to when back in the early days of 3D graphics, like games would ship with lookup tables for certain math equations, like square root, for example, that was too slow to do in real time. So they would just have a lookup table of saying, you know, if you're looking for the square root of this number, then it should be this. It's like already pre-computed. And that's sort of what we're doing here as well. And I was thinking a lot about that. Like, what would be the equivalent of doing that in like an iOS app these days? And I sort of started thinking about code generation, where, you know, if you have certain things in the app that need to be performed that you can know ahead of time what the results might be, instead of performing those lookups dynamically, then you can do that with code generation. So an example of this, I feel like, is a resource lookup. Like, instead of inlining strings in line where you look up your image names or your localized strings, if you have that generated with code generation, then you can just access that statically. So it's statically known that this is the resource. And I feel like these techniques all have something in common, right? It's that we're pre-computing some known results in order to save time in terms of performance.
Yeah, definitely. And I'm really happy with how it came out. And I've done some other stuff that makes the website feel dynamic, because I've done this whole metadata thing, because Publish does support metadata and I am using that, but I've also expanded it to support metadata references. And I don't think this is in the Publish fork that I've made. This is a plugin that I wrote, basically. So when you have a podcast, you have the hosts, but you might have some episodes where, let's say, the podcast has four hosts. Maybe like one of them wasn't on that episode. So there is a metadata field in the episode markdown that you can write the names of the hosts that were or weren't in that episode. And if you don't put that metadata key in there, then it means that all hosts were present for that episode. And where do you define the hosts? Well, you define the hosts in the index markdown file for that podcast. So that will list all of the hosts for that podcast. But then hosts also have Twitter usernames and GitHub links or whatnot and avatar pictures. And I didn't want to have that be like JSON files or something, which would be perfectly fine if it was just me like messing with the website. But since I want it to be accessible And I want, like, the only technical knowledge I want people to have to know is Markdown, basically. Like, if you know Markdown, you can get around. So I've done all of this work. So if we have like a folder where you have a Markdown file for each one of the people involved in the network, so the hosts that host the shows, and based on the name of the person, at build time, it's going to look up, oh, this is Guy Rambo, so this is his metadata and his Twitter link, and it basically turns that into metadata. So if you go to the page on the website that shows my avatar and like my biography and my links, you also have like the recent episodes I've been on. And I've also built a way for you to register guests. So sometimes you might have a guest on the show. So the way I've decided to do it is within that metadata field where you list the people who've been on that episode, if you put the person's name as you would like do like the emphasis in Markdown, so with underscores around it, that means that person was a guest. And then that plugin that resolves the metadata knows, okay, so this person was not a host, it was a guest, and so on. So I've done a bunch of stuff like that, which means that when I write my components in Plot, I can get access to this really rich metadata. And from the publishing context, and this context, I do like the publishing context.
It's a Rambo approved context.
So from the publishing context, I can get like, if I have a person, oh, which episode has this person been a host or a guest, or which podcast is this person a fixed host, and all of that good stuff. And I've done the same for like feed links and subscription links for different podcast services. Everything that can be metadata has been like parameterized in a certain way.
That's super cool. And I love how you've essentially built like a relational database using Markdown.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. And, you know, when certain people listen to this, they might start feeling like, why are you doing all of this stuff? Like, why are you not using like some existing solution like a relational database that already does all of these things, right? And I think like this is where it comes down to like, do you want to build something like that is a little bit custom, but it's specific for what you're trying to build? Like in your case, like the whole system you've built here, it's specific for gigahertz, right? It's specific for building this podcast network. It's optimized for that. You've made it as user-friendly as you could. You will probably build some kind of UI on top of that in the future, and then that can be even more user-friendly. You've set things up so that this is specific for what you're building. It can be as fast as possible. It's optimized in all certain ways for caching and all those sorts of things that you talked about. And that is kind of what you get from building a very specific custom implementation compared to taking something kind of more off the shelf that you would then have to spend some time actually tweaking it so that it works for your use case. And you might not even get there. You might end up with something that's a little bit slower than it could be and so on, but because you use that more kind of general solution. And that is always, I feel like, the trade-off. Like, it's not to say one way is better than the other, but, you know, you were clearly, like, excited about this, right? Like, hearing you talk about these things, and this was fun for you to build it, and you ended up with something that is, like, greatly tailored to what you wanted to build in the end. And I feel like that is something that shouldn't be disregarded when you're thinking about different solutions. Like, sure, if you build something that is more specific, you will spend more time and engineering effort actually building that out, but you could end up with something that is a really nice fit for what you actually want to build, like the product that you're shipping. So even if you did end up kind of creating your own relational database in Markdown, like now it's done and now it works and now you can just ship all these podcasts and it's all just super smooth. So probably was worth it in the end, right?
Yeah, definitely. And there's also a thing where I am not a web developer anymore. I used to be, and I stopped doing it because I was tired of it and I hated it. So being able to do web development in a way that's enjoyable to me is also incredibly valuable. And also using the tools that I'm used to, because I didn't have to learn how to like configure WordPress or do like some weird Node.js thing, even though I kind of like Node.js and I have written some stuff in Node.js for gigahertz that's tied to other stuff. But not having to learn something new, because this is published, this is Swift, it's all stuff that I know, and there's something like really empowering about the feeling that I can do anything with this tooling. Like, if something is not there yet, I can build it. And that wouldn't be true of like WordPress or Node.js, I'm a bit more familiar with, but still, like, I have to search Stack Overflow for a lot of stuff or use GitHub Copilot. So, being able to like use the tooling that I'm already familiar with and not having to learn something completely new, and having the, like, at the back of my mind, the peace of mind that anything that's not already there, I can write but the solution for, because I am very comfortable with Swift and with Publish. That's definitely like a huge plus. And we're talking about all of the stuff, it sounds like a really complicated, and like I took like 4 months, but in reality, if I were to sum up the hours spent producing the stuff, I think it was probably like in total like 2 weeks of work. It took a little bit more because I wasn't working full time on this, but it wasn't that much time that I spent. I think if I were to try to adapt some existing thing, I would have spent more time, and then I wouldn't have full control over everything. And another aspect of static site generation that I really love is there are no surprises.
Yeah.
Like, it's just a static thing that's on the server. It's not going to crash in the middle of the night. Like, it's Nginx and the Cloudflare cache in front of it. Yeah, it might go down if Cloudflare is having some issue, or if the server goes down at some point, the Cloudflare cache is going to expire and it's not going to work. But it gives you peace of mind as well, because I don't want to be a server maintainer as well. So knowing that it's all just static stuff on a server and it's not going to go down in the middle of the night because the MySQL database proxy with the socket file exceeded the maximum file descriptors or whatever. That, like, it's really liberating to be able to put this up and not have to worry about that stuff.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's also a very big reason why I love static site generation so much. And, you know, you touched also on some aspects of Swift as a language, which was a very big motivator for me to actually build Publish. And that's the generic system that we also talked about earlier in this episode, right? Yeah. Where since we can embed so much information statically into the type system, like you talked about, you could add these metadata fields and you could add all this custom stuff. But then when you're actually using it in your code, it's all there available statically. Like, you can access those properties as if they were built into the framework. And that is just like the power of Swift's generics model. And that's what I felt like when I first started investigating building something like Publish and doing static site generation in Swift was, you know, what would be the point? Like, what would I gain from building all of this stuff out? And getting all that static type information and then combining that with static site generation itself, like you said, once it's generated, you're sure that it works, or you're at least sure that what you upload to the server is what users are going to see, right? Like, there's no surprises there. And combine that then with that static type information, it's like, it's almost like you get double the safety, if you will, or you get like double checking all of your work. And I found that to be so compelling. And it's also been working out so well, both for me and you, it sounds like, and a lot of other people as well, is that you can, you know, continue to add your own very custom stuff to the library, like your own features, your own data, and it's all just there statically available thanks to Swift generics. And, you know, you don't make any mistakes where you accidentally mistype a property name in your template because, you know, you changed it or something. No, it won't even compile if you do that.
Yeah, exactly. And not only that, but also type safety helps to validate everything. And one of the things I did while I was developing this is I was very strict about validation. So if anything is not quite right, the website's just not gonna finish building, and in the sense of building the actual website with Publish, not building the Swift code. So if like it can't resolve the metadata for something, it will just throw an error and stop right there and tell you, hey, I hit a problem finding out like which show you're talking about in this episode markdown file, because I don't have that show in my markdown database. So yeah, I think it's better that way, that it stops from generating a broken website. I can see the error right there, just fix whatever caused the error and keep going. And when I publish like a UI for other people to be able to use, publish basically by putting the markdown files in there and whatnot, I'll then be able to surface those validation errors. So it will try to build the website on like a scratch Docker container that will only be used for previewing basically, and it will be able to tell the user, hey, I couldn't generate the website because you mistyped this person's name in this markdown file. But I don't think that's even gonna happen, because what I'm actually thinking about doing is even going beyond the need for the person to know the markdown syntax, but actually like build a little UI where they will build out this metadata. And what's cool about that is I can leverage the API that was generated using publish to...
Like, it all comes full circle.
Exactly. Yeah. So I can provide like completion suggestions for people's names and shows and whatnot. So yeah, it's a bit of like a circular thing in there, where publish will help inform publish of publish stuff.
Awesome. I love it. All right, so definitely looking forward to hearing more about Gigahertz, you know, as you continue to expanding the network and as you continue to build new features as well. I love that we can dive into static site generation on certain episodes. I know that not everyone who's listened to this podcast is like building static websites, but hopefully it's interesting to hear us talk about these things, because it's not just about how we're building the websites, but it's about how we reason about things like architecture and how to pick what tools we want to use, and thinking about tech stacks and things like that. I think like that is always what I found the most interesting with projects these days, is thinking about them. Like, of course, it's interesting to write the code as well, and that's something that we do like 90% of the time, but taking a step back and thinking about things more kind of how do things connect together, and how can we optimize not just this one function or this one class, but how can we optimize the system, right? To think about the whole system level. I find that to be so interesting, both to talk about and to do the actual work as well.
Yeah, I love it.
So we are a little bit more than an hour into what was supposed to be our WWDC episode. but we haven't really talked about WWDC, so let's do that right now. But thankfully, you know, we like to say this, and it's something we can repeat here as well. And it's not just an excuse, but, you know, WWDC, like the things we get, you know, that we hear about during WWDC, it's not something we have to rush into, like, adopting or learning like on day one. Like, we can take our time, and I think both of us, mainly because we've been so busy with other things, like we're taking our time, right? Like, yeah. Of course, sometimes you might want to really jump on a new feature to get it ready on day one of the new operating system to, you know, get promotion or get attention and so on. So that's a different thing. But when it comes to like an existing code base you're working on, you of course want to make sure that it compiles and it works well and there are no regressions on the new operating system. But the way I treat these things is I treat them as like, here's the roadmap for the next year.
Yeah.
And I might start adopting a new API in like March next year, right? Like, yeah, that's fine. Like, for me, there's no rush, unless there's, of course, again, some regression, or I want to time implementing a new feature with some big new release or marketing promotion or something like that. But that's like a special case, I feel like. But for this episode, how about, Rambo, we do a little lightning round here. We just talk about some of our favorite new additions that we've been exploring so far. Because, you know, like I just said, we're taking our time. We haven't necessarily tried every single API yet. But what have been some highlights for you as you've been starting to explore the new APIs that were released this year at WWDC 22?
Yeah, so like you mentioned, I also have the same approach as you have. I do have a bit of a, not really a rush, but I do want to probably release Airbuddy 3 at around when macOS Ventura goes out, because it will have some stuff for Ventura. But in general, it's the same. Like, there's a lot of cool new stuff that I don't really rush to adopt. But of course, I have been trying some stuff out. So some of my highlights would be the focus filters APIs, and the way you can provide both provide context to the system about whether your app should be treated as like a member of a given focus mode, or like even offer users the ability to customize what happens in your app when different focus modes are enabled. I think that's really cool, and it is something that I will look into for AirBuddy, definitely, for like maybe in a certain focus mode you don't want to see battery alerts or whatnot. So yeah, I definitely want to check that out. Another big one for me is extension kit, and how on the Mac at least we are now able to define our own extension points for Mac apps, where third parties can provide extensions for our apps that will run in a complete sandbox, completely separate from the main app, just like the native extensions have worked in the past. And the way it's all built using Swift, and the entry point is a net main thing in Swift, which is very similar to something that I've written for, like that prototype that I showed you for widgets, where mm-hmm. I had this basically what was like a Rainbow widget SDK, where the way you would define your widget was a net main struct, and it was an extension, but it wasn't quite the same as this, of course, because I'm not Apple. So I'm very happy that they've done this. And the documentation for this one wasn't that great, because it was missing a key piece of information on how to define your own extension point. But fortunately, with the help of others in the community, I figured it out. And there is a blog post and sample code that we can link to in the show notes that I've written. And also another big one for me is WeatherKit. Because when we made the widget for Chibi Studio, we made this calendar widget. And another one we wanted to make was this Chibi Weather widget. But back then, I would have to sign up for some weather provider API and have to deal with the billing for that and all of that stuff that I really didn't want to deal with. And now with WeatherKit, we are working on a weather widget for Chibi Studio. So that's really exciting. So those would be like my quick highlights in terms of APIs.
All right. Super cool. Yeah, those are some really good picks. And I will probably be quite predictable here and pick mostly like I've been mostly exploring like the Swift and Swift UI features, because there's a lot of new things in Swift UI that kind of open up a lot of new use cases. And one of them that I've been exploring quite a bit is the new layout protocol, which is super interesting, where we can now for the first time like gain complete control over the way Swift UI views are placed within a container. So essentially it lets us re-implement, if we wanted to, things like HStack and VStack in our own code. Like we get that same capability as the built-in containers do. And the kind of sort of a meta aspect of this that I find very compelling is that it sort of demystifies the framework, because it lifts some of those things that were previously hidden details within the framework into the public API to say, like, you know, layout is no longer this mystical thing that you just have to know how it works or try to figure out how it works. Here's a protocol how it works, right? And that I feel like is so valuable. And I really hope for future releases that they will go through more aspects of the framework and do something similar. Like, for example, I would love for every styling protocol that exists, not just button style and a few others like label style, but all of them to be completely publicly available so that we can define our own styling for any Swift UI components. That would be great, because it would serve the same purpose, right? It would demystify what goes on in styling those built-in components. And it would also give us so much more flexibility. For example, imagine being able to write your own list style. How great wouldn't that be?
Also, another one that's a big one for me, custom gestures, so that we could like inherit from the gesture protocol and handle touches or clicks or whatnot manually in there. That would also be great, because currently, whenever I need some custom gesture that doesn't exist in Swift UI and that can't be built by combining the existing ones, I have to resort to basically going to AppKit and like embedding an AppKit view that's just gonna intercept the clicks or whatnot. Just did that yesterday actually for a thing in AirBuddy, because I needed to get right clicks, and you can't really do that in Swift UI. And it wasn't that much work. Like, it was fine, but I would prefer to have all of that stuff natively supported.
Yeah, I think one way of looking at it is that if you look at AppKit and UIKit, those APIs have been quote-unquote very deep, where what I mean by that is that you can start at the surface, like you can start at the very high level of the framework, and then you can dive deeper and deeper and deeper, and you can kind of keep going, right? You can go all the way down to metal, and you can write your own like shaders and your own graphics context if you want to do that, right?
Yeah.
But you have all these steps in between, where Swift UI so far, at least like up until this point, it has been super shallow, where it's basically like you can take this component, you can use it, and then that's it, right? There's no way to kind of dive deeper. But with this new layout protocol and with some of the other new features being introduced, I feel like it's starting to get more depth. And I think this is super important. I think for Swift UI to get success in on a long-term basis and get more adoption and get like just become a really, really powerful, very usable UI framework, it needs to not just cater to use cases, because I feel like that's so much what we talk about. Like, what use cases does it support, right? Yep. I think we need to go beyond that. And we need to say, it's not just about fulfilling this or that use case about, will you build a list or a button or whatever? It just needs to be this like continuous UI framework that you can build anything using just by diving deeper and deeper into different levels of abstraction, right? And that's why I think like these, like you said, like custom gestures, custom rendering, custom layout that we have now, like these things are so important. And I hope that that trend continues into the future.
Yeah, and it makes sense that they've waited and they are waiting because, like you mentioned, I think Natalia mentioned in the recent episode of Swift by Sandel, she actually worked in Swift UI at Apple a while back, and she was mentioning how they are super careful about when to make an API public. And just like you mentioned that you do with Publish itself, I think that makes sense, and I totally understand because once you make something public, you kind of have to keep it there, and you can deprecate it, of course, but it doesn't really make sense to deprecate it like 6 months after the initial release. And I think a lot of this stuff, like the layout thing, is basically exposing an implementation detail of the framework. And let's imagine like what the implementation detail for gesture looks like right now. Maybe it's something that's going to change next year. And they already know that, oh, we're currently using this thing for gestures, but by next year, we'll have this other thing for gestures that will be the implementation detail. And then maybe next year, we can finally open up this implementation detail so that it's no longer just an implementation detail, but something that developers can leverage.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely understand why it's taking some time. And one way to look at it, I feel like, is kind of like when you're exposing an implementation detail, like the new layout protocol, or when you're making a more foundational aspect of a framework public, like we talked about, like you mentioned, like with Publish, like making, for example, the RSS feed generator in Publish public, like which is currently an implementation detail, is sort of the same thing. It's like you're basically taking something more foundational and putting it as part of the public API. And you don't want to build those sorts of API on a kind of shaky foundation, right? You want the foundation to be super solid. And for the first couple of iterations on anything, like on any kind of library or anything like that, it's always going to be a sort of shaky foundation because you haven't really finalized everything. You haven't really discovered what am I supposed to support here, right? Like what sort of features do we want the framework to have, or what sort of different use cases do we think about supporting? And that really influences how those foundational tools need to be built, and they need to be refactored and changed over time. And you don't want to do that in the public, right? Like you want that to be something you can do internally that just makes you move so much faster. You don't have to worry about breaking everyone's code. And then once you feel like this is stabilizing, now the foundation is solid, that's when you can start moving it into the public API. So I understand that this is taking a while. So I'm just being a little bit impatient here. I just want everything now, but I'm really hoping like, you know, iOS 17 or 18 or whenever it will be that, you know, the focus will really be that Swift UI will become a more deep framework in terms of the API service, that you will be able to dive deeper into the framework itself, not just to say, oh, if you want to do this custom thing, then you just use UIKit, which is kind of currently the way to go.
Yeah. And like we mentioned, it's fine. Like, the thing where I had to use AppKit for right clicks, I didn't have to rewrite the whole view in AppKit. I wrote a view modifier that puts an AppKit view in the background, basically, just so that I can pass on those mouse events back into the Swift UI world. It was probably like 50 lines of code, and now it's there, and I can use it anywhere where I need to use it. So yeah, at the end of the day, it wasn't that big a deal. It would definitely be worse if they opened up everything and it was all broken and deprecated by the next year.
Yeah, exactly. So another thing that I've been exploring a little bit and I find very, very interesting is the new customizable toolbars on iPad. And speaking about, you know, getting the foundation right and then being able to build upon that, I find it so cool that there are all these super fundamental APIs from UIKit, like UI Table View, UI Collection View, which came later, but still it's at this point a pretty foundational technology, and UI Navigation Item and these sorts of things that have been around for so many years, they are now getting these brand new features and brand new behaviors in a way that just, you know, still maintains full backward compatibility, because another aspect is now we can inline Swift UI views within table views and collection views. And that just works with the new content configuration API that was introduced a few years ago, again, building on a foundation, right? And like continue to expand that. And with the customizable toolbars, like the way that's implemented, where you can just like define that certain navigation item should go into this center customizable area on your navigation item. And it all sort of just works, even though it's using that same API as normal navigation items are defined using. I just find that really fascinating in terms of API design, and also really cool that these features are now making their way to the iPad from the Mac, like being able to customize toolbars. I think that's really cool.
Yeah, I'm actually thinking about making the Chibi Studio Canvas view a little bit more native on iPad specifically, and like actually use the new toolbar stuff, because it sounds really cool, like so that users would be able to put the tools in there that they like to use the most. And yeah, the current toolbar was made for iPhone, basically, and it also works on iPad, but I think the new native customizable toolbars definitely look really great.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, there are many more things like Swift Charts that is really cool, and I've been exploring a little bit as well. And yeah, there's a lot of cool things this year, but I must say that I haven't found any like must implement new API that I feel like, you know, this is something that most apps should implement, like a new framework or something new that integrates with the system. Maybe like the new lock screen widgets would be that feature that many apps might want to support with WidgetKit. But apart from that, I haven't found any like, you know, here's this one framework that many apps will probably add support for. It feels like more like an iterative year and more kind of adding more tools to our toolbox, which isn't bad. I think that's really great, actually. But what do you think, Rambo?
Yeah, I sort of agree. I think it hugely depends, as always, on the type of app that you're making. I think there are certain types of apps where users are absolutely going to expect lock screen widgets. So if you have any app that present some sort of glanceable information, and it can be whatever has that sort of data. I think the common examples are like weather apps or calendar and task managers, but there are definitely lots of other apps. Maybe even like, I think the example they gave in the talk was like a game where you have to wait for your character to regenerate or something. And I mean, I would never put something like that on my lock screen, but there are some people who are really into games and they want to know that on their lock screen. So why not? I think there are lots of opportunities there. Not so much for like actual visual customization, because the widgets on the lock screen are quite limited for a good reason. I think the new live activities API that's coming later is probably going to be more broad and offer more opportunities for some sorts of apps. So I think that one will be a must implement in the eyes of users of apps like ride hailing apps and grocery shopping apps, those sorts of apps, sports, of course, where you want to have this live updating information for a while. And another one that I think, if you have any app where there might be data that the user doesn't want to see in some context, then the new focus filters API is definitely something you have to look into, like email apps or task managers, messaging apps, those sorts of apps. I think will definitely want to adopt the focus filters, because I think users will expect to be able to hide their work email on the weekends or something like that. So definitely look into that if you have or if you work on any app that, has that sort of data.
Yeah, and the good thing about those features is that I feel like they can mostly be implemented incrementally, right? Where you don't need to like bump your minimum deployment target to iOS 16 to use them, which is definitely the case if you want to start using like the new Swift UI layout tools. Like it's hard to gradually implement your layout for different versions, right? Unless you're building some screen that is only supposed to be on the new operating system versions, of course, which is a strategy that you can use depending on the app and so on. But adding support for example, lock screen widgets and these sorts of things that you mentioned, like that's great that you can do that without like dropping backward compatibility in your app, which is really, really great.
Yeah, I think there are some things like Swift charts, for example. If you have something in your app where maybe it would be cool to have charts, but you don't have charts currently and you want to add charts because it's now easy to make charts, maybe you can make that feature be only available on iOS 16. Like if you don't have it already and you don't want to build it and it's not like a core piece of functionality of your app, then you can definitely adopt some of these things piecemeal. And I would say even the layout tool, like of course it depends on the way you're doing things, but I find that the declarative nature of Swift UI makes it so you can sometimes have completely different layouts for the same thing. Of course you wouldn't build an entire app like that, but if you have a screen where you think you could improve it with a dynamic layout, you can maybe do that behind an if available and just keep using the old version for older operating systems.
Yeah, that is tricky though, because that basically makes it harder to maintain, I feel like, and also harder to do QA work on it as well, because then you basically have these two completely separate code paths and you have to make sure that both of them work well. And when you add a new feature, you have to make sure it fits in both. It, of course, like you said, it depends, and depends on what it is that this layout is actually doing. And if you're, again, building something that is mainly like optional or something, you're fine hiding behind that if available check and only enabling for iOS 16 users, then absolutely. But I am always very careful to not create too many code branches in my code, because I just know that then I'm going to have to just do a lot more testing work.
Yeah, definitely. That's why I am bumping the deployment target for everybody. Because, and I think that's also why I am not as scared of doing this, because I have to do it so much due to hardware stuff and OS support. So I am a bit more used to this. But yeah, in general, the stuff where I am doing this, it's more like lower level things where things have changed between OS versions, not like a whole UI. So I totally get it.
Yeah. And also it sounds like from talking to you about these things, like it's so much for you about adding compatibility for a new version rather than like you go back and iterate on the old code, right? Like once the old code is working, it's kind of there hidden behind the abstraction and that's all good. And then when a new operating system version comes out and you need to like modify the Bluetooth stack for that or something, then you add that to your overall existing abstraction, or you create a new abstraction. But when you have a layout, which is this kind of like living thing usually, where it's like you still want iOS 15 and 14 users perhaps to see that same content, so you would need to update the old layout as well, right? So that's a slightly different, I feel like. But yeah, definitely like something to keep in mind that is not a complete impossibility to have different layouts for different operating system versions.
Yeah, I think you can do that if it's something that you can basically put in maintenance mode for older OSs. So if you have a view where it's currently a list and you think you can make a cool layout for it, but you don't expect to like completely change the underlying data or something like that, then you can probably make something for that and just keep the old branch in the code in maintenance mode, basically where you don't change it. But yeah, of course, this is something I would only do like very sparingly depending on the circumstances, and probably only if I'm working by myself, not as a team, because then things get more complicated.
Yeah, for sure. All right, so hope you enjoyed this episode of Stack Trace. It was sort of a really fun mix, I feel like, between some of the new APIs and technologies announced at WWDC 22, Rambo's adventures through static site generation, maintaining code, releases. You know, we had all sorts of things during this episode. So hope you enjoyed listening to it. And like always, feel free to reach out if you have any questions or if you just want to provide some feedback on our show. That's always really appreciated. You can find us both on Twitter. I am at John Sundell and Mr. Rambo is at underscore inside. And if you want to send us an email, then you can do that using the email address ask@stacktracepodcast.fm. But that's it for this episode. So thanks so much for listening, and we'll talk to you again soon. Say goodbye, Mr. Rambo.
Goodbye.